Hey, this is the Partially Examined Life, episode 392, part two. We've been talking about Hegel's essay, Faith and Knowledge, from 1802. And I think you wanted to say something, Seth, when we stopped here.
Right. So when we closed out part one, Wes had mentioned the Romantics and the idea that an artifact has this sort of beautiful external appearance, but part of the aesthetic experience is to look through that into it, and there's something inside of it, so to speak, that connects you to the absolute or to the universal or to the infinite, however you want to characterize it. And initially, I wasn't sure. I realized I'd lost the thread. I'm assuming that Wes was not saying that this was the Kantian position, but that he was sort of talking more about aligning Hegel with the Romantics, or at least saying the Hegelian view is similar to this. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I was associating,
not exactly, but...
Yeah, but Hegel, all of these guys get this out of the third critique of, you know, the critique of judgment, where there's something special about aesthetic judgment, also called or reflective judgment. And it's not just aesthetic judgment, but it's the type of judgment where we can understand that organic beings seem to be intelligently designed. And then in judgments of beauty, there's an element of those where the world seems to be designed for our senses. So there's the inherent teleology to this. And this is the other aspect. Hegel is all about this teleology. He thinks this is also critical. And even Kant himself, in his, you know, even though he argued against the argument for God from intelligent design, Kant was most fond of that argument, had a place in his heart for it. So I think that's another thing that these guys actually do take seriously. But sorry, I was kind of leading us astray from Seth's main point here, which is that there's something about the aesthetic and beauty that connects us to the divine.
Well, it's that there is a form of subject-object relationship that takes one beyond appearance to something else. And you were talking earlier about Spinoza and, you know, Dylan, we were talking about the idea that, you know, if one of the moves to counteract Hegel's criticism, if you think of subjectivity as being, you know, this form of idealism, right, is to connect that subject to the divine, to the absolute, to the universal. And then you talk about either a self-relation or a relation to other, where you see past the particular, right, of the individual. And you have that same kind of relation that we're talking about, the aesthetic relation, the ability to connect beyond the appearance to, quote unquote, the thing in itself, which is, we just recently did some episodes where we're talking about, no, you actually do connect to the thing itself, you know, beyond the. And so, you know, I think I went back and I was trying to find the notes, and Hegel's complaint here, and this is where I think we get that Hegelian structure, but I want to kind of try to tease it out. So 64, he says, the idealism of which these philosophies, he's talking about all three, Kant, Jacobi, and Fichte, are capable is an idealism of the finite, not in the sense that the finite is nothing in them, but in the sense that the finite is received into ideal form. They posit finite ideality, i.e. the pure concept, as infinitely opposed to the finitude, together with the finite that is real, and they posit both absolutely. And a little further down, he says, truth, however, cannot be deceived by this sort of hallowing of a finitude that remains what it was. A true hallowing should nullify the finite. If an artist cannot give true truth to what actually exists by casting an ethereal light upon it and taking it wholly up therein, if he is only able to represent actuality in and for itself, which is what is commonly called reality and truth, then it is neither the one nor the other. He will take refuge in feeling, yearning, sentimentality as his remedy against actuality, spreading tears on the cheeks of the vulgar and bringing a, quote, an oh Lord to their lips. So I guess there is a form of the absolute or a form of ideality that we can make of finitude. And that in itself is impoverished, that instead there's some way where we should be grasping an absolute, which is not an idealization of finitude. So the thing in itself is the absolute ideal of, you know, the sense, the manifold of intuition or sense, you know, the intuitions, and the ego is the idealization, the absolute idealization of subjectivity. And then he says, you know, these are put in opposition to each other. So what I'm trying to understand is, what is impoverished about that? If I can answer the question of why Hegel thinks this is insufficient, and I don't want to hear, well, he's trying to save the idea of God, or he wants to save the idea that we can get to God through reason. So that's not helpful.
Why he thinks what is insufficient?
That an absolute ideal made out of finitude, taking finitude and idealizing it in this way, is somehow, it does not accomplish what he thinks needs to be accomplished. And he thinks this is why you get stuck in idealism.
I don't mean to be glib, but I think it's as simple as the absolute and being an infinity is and always will be bigger than any finitude ever would be. And therefore, you're missing something true about the world. You're missing, and if you say that the infinite exists, but we don't have access to it, this gets to his teleological things. It's like, it exists in the world and I must have access to it.
Yeah, I think, Seth, you know, you could say, well, I'm an atheist and the finite is all well and good for me, and that's all I have access to, and it's also all I believe in. For someone with a religious yearning, they're going to want they're going to want a little bit of infinity in there. They're going to want some infinite. What Hegel especially doesn't like, if you grant the idea that we need some sort of relationship to the infinite, to God, he doesn't like the idea that this can be the Kantian relationship of just faith in something that we can't characterize or know, that's thinkable but not knowable, which hollows out religion and leaves it subject to sentimentality instead of the more subtle artistic things that he's talking about, right? The representation of the ethereal, for instance. He thinks that art can actually do the work of connecting us to God, but not once we become religious in this Kantian way, where it's just God is unrepresentable on the one hand, but we can have all these maudlin feelings towards him on the other.
So, okay. I mean, I think this is helpful, philosophy and improv, Mark. So really what he's criticizing in these three Enlightenment rationalists is not so much the idealism in itself, but an idealism that gives over to faith something that he thinks belongs to reason, namely access to the absolute, to God, to the infinite. And is that a fair characterization?
Yep, I think so.
And Kant did that willingly, though, right? And Kant was perfectly happy to say, there's things we can't know anything about, but we know they exist.
He was, because he thought, right, and those are the things that include things in themselves, that whatever's producing the sense data for us, but God and the substantial soul especially, because he saw the problem with metaphysics, which is that they're not empirical objects. And when we argue about metaphysical objects, we just get ourselves into endless tangles, kind of medieval scholasticism, because there's no way to check. You know, we can apply some concept to God or some other concept to God. We can say the soul is this way. We can say the soul is that way. But we can't ever go into a laboratory and say, okay, I'm going to see, put the soul on a slide and under a microscope and check and see if my metaphysical statement is actually true. So he thinks that Kant thought this kind of made religion ridiculous. And who would, I think for Kant, he thought it was something that would lead people to be less faithful because the arguments are so ridiculous. He wanted to make room for faith by admitting we can't know it and we can't have these metaphysical conversations about it. Kant wasn't just trying to throw in he thought he was doing something good by making this admission. He thought he was preserving a little space for faith. And in the face of the onslaught of modern science and the Enlightenment, right? What are you going to do? You got a rear guard action. You got to make a little place for faith, I think Kant thought. And Hegel's like, no, we can make it everything. Not faith, but right, the absolute.
This is making me rethink what I was characterizing as the simplest possible version of the ontological argument, which is I am limited, therefore there is an unlimited, which is God. That could be the bad kind of faith, because God is just whatever is not me. Like, I can't actually characterize it. It could be just that could be a description of a Kantian version, which is not to say that there's a God, but that there is a thing in itself that if there, you know, something beyond limitation, it would be shoved on that side of the aisle. If we're going to say that it somehow, this being aware of my limitation as in contradistinction to God's existence, to God's presence, then that means casting an ethereal light upon it. It's the quote that he says the artist is doing. So it's some, but I'm not sure that I fully understand that, because it's not supposed to be just mere abstract reason that there is a God out there, but it can't be mere feeling. So intellectual intuition seems to be the only thing that's left, right? The thing that Kant wanted to deny that we had. So is that, you know, what we're using to determine the existence of the absolute, is this intellectual intuition?
I think he wants to identify intellectual intuition and aesthetic intuition. And intellectual intuition has something to do with the imagination, right? The synthesis of the imagination that Kant sees purely as subjective, but that Hegel, I think, sees as part of the ontology of the world, since the world is just God, right? In a Spinozan way. You were asking if it's aesthetic intuition or intellectual intuition?
Intellectual intuition, yeah. But I think you took us on a good differentiator, which is really the first argument in the Kant section, right? Which ultimately is going to be talking about what is Kant's insight into the, how is synthetic judgments a priori possible? I mean, is it okay if we move to that area, or are there more to say before that that we need to do first?
Yeah, we can go there. He thinks that Kant in this, when he asks how a priori synthetic judgments are possible, he's getting at something very deep, because in a way that's going to be what all judgments are for Hegel. They are all a priori synthetic. They are all come down to an identity of what he calls an identity of objects, which is to say the particular and the universal get identified. And the copula is, the rose is red, or this particular thing is red. The universal is predicated of the particular. But Hegel wants to take this very straightforwardly as saying that at some deep level of reality, universal and particular are the same thing. And that's the level where God is, right? Prior to subject, which is associated with the universal, and prior to the object, which is associated with the particular, we have this primordial unity, and they get separated out in the judgment.
I think that's a great way of putting the I am finite, therefore there's infinity, not as a syllogism, but I am finite. Sorry, repeat the end of what you just said. I grasped something.
Right, that universal in particular at a primordial level are already, they're antitheses to each other that are already combined, and then they come out, they emerge from each other in the act of conscious judgment.
So it's the thing that we've got over and over and again in the phenomenology is I don't want to perceive myself as a mere singular individual. I want to perceive myself qua universal. So if I say there's two ways of saying I'm finite, one is saying that I am this finite singular individual, and the other is saying I am a species of finitude. All right, I'm almost there, but we're not quite there yet. We'll come back to it.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I do some super dumb stuff about this synthetic analytic thing?
Yeah.
Just
sure.
Okay. So, what does it mean for something to be synthetic? A synthetic judgment. So, for Kant, there's two, at least there might be more, but let's just focus on two. Analytic judgments, which are what we would traditionally call something like a tautology. This is a statement that does not give you any new information about a thing. So the classic example is A equals A, right? A synthetic judgment is something that predicates, there's something predicated of something else. Another way to think of it is it's a statement that tells you something. It theoretically, the concept of the predicate is not contained within the concept of the subject. So if I say A is B, I'm giving some new information there, because B and A are different. They are not identical. And yet I'm saying A equals B. So I'm saying they are identical. They're not identical because they don't have the same identical content. And yet I am creating an identification with that statement, A equals B or A is B.
Right. So in contemporary analytic philosophy, the favorite example of an analytic proposition or judgment is all bachelors are unmarried. It's true by definition. I think Kant in the Critique gives an example of, you know, saying all bodies are extended is an analytic judgment because extension is just inside the concept of body. You do a little conceptual analysis and you get extension out of it. But normally we just think a posteriori contingent empirical judgments are the things that are synthetic, right? Before Kant, those two things are usually identified. If I say, oh, this table in here that I'm sitting at happens to be white, I'm combining two things that don't necessarily go together as they do in an analytic judgment. But Kant thought he identified a class of judgments which were both synthetic and a priori. One of his famous examples is 7 plus 5 equals 12 in mathematics. And it's synthetic in the sense it has to be underwritten by our intuition of time. Everything that's going to be synthetic here is going to be underwritten by space or time or the categories. So to give an example in the categories, every event has a cause, right? Hume thought there wasn't, right? We couldn't legitimately know that. But Kant is going to say, actually, that's an a priori synthetic judgment, not an analytic judgment, and not just something that's about the relationship between our ideas or something like that. And the importance of that is just that's what science is, right? Science is saying that, right, there are all these necessary causal relationships between things that can't just be like Hume. Well, for all we know, they're not actually, they could be contingent, you know? Maybe the billiard ball knocking into the one doesn't always make it move or something like that. We just have to do induction and say, okay, it was so far, it's been okay. But Kant wants to say, no, at a very deep level, we kind of grasp the necessity and we do that because we have already baked it in through the synthesis of the imagination, has already shoved all of that into experience. And then we, at a conscious level, when we make the judgment, we can refamiliarize ourselves with something, this a priori necessary element, causality, that has already been baked into experience and in fact is a condition of the possibility of experience. And the way Hegel is going to take this is that, yeah, what we're encountering there is not just the form of our own subjectivity, is not just something that we've baked into experience. It really is there. It's the, if you want to say anything, Hegel would object to this, but you know, it's God's imagination that it's already baked it into experience. And we participate in the larger consciousness that can grasp it.
So in that description, Hegel would object to saying its causality is an a priori synthetic judgment. Kant gets to it because causality isn't derivable the way all bachelors are single,
all bachelors are unmarried men.
All bachelors are unmarried men.
But predication can work just as well. This is important, I think, that any is statement, because most is statements are not a substantive, is B another substantive, like all bachelors are unmarried males. Both of those are plural nouns. Even saying a bachelor is single is also an equivocation on this account. Anyway, go ahead.
Are you saying that I was just using another example of it? Or are you saying that it's a different thing?
Well, usually we say that, you know, if you say a bachelor is single, then you're saying something, you're attributing a predicate, an adjective, in this case, single, to a noun or is running or whatever. All rivers are something like that. But these grammatical things do not matter when I think in Hegel's view of these, predication is still equivocation. So all uses of is are saying this thing is equivalent to this, which is very weird to say a noun is the same as an adjective or something like that. Well, but I think this is ultimately,
the particular is the universal, right? There's identity, yeah, and difference. And his idea is that at a deep level, right, before consciousness gets to it, those two things aren't actually separated. They're there together in a primordial unity, which precedes subject and object and precedes particular and universal. So they really are identical, but there's a kind of, there's difference in there nonetheless. And we extract the difference in the act of judgment. So that our judgment, yes, we aren't really, you know, he understands we aren't saying that the rose is redness, but he thinks it reflects this deeper truth that that particular rose is fused to universality at a deep level. It's not, you know what I'm saying?
Well, no, I don't. So okay. I just want to repeat the sentence. The sentence was that though they are identical, but nonetheless different.
Yeah, it's okay. Identity in difference. This is his favorite thing. And because he thinks that, right, all identities are about difference. He doesn't believe in bare tautology identities. He thinks all identities are ampliative in the sense that Seth was bringing up. That's what the synthetic a priori is all about.
And didn't Quine also say that, right? He denied the analytic synthetic distinction because even if you're saying a bachelor is an unmarried male, the fact that you're using different words means you're actually still picking out different concepts, right? Linguistically distinct concepts, which have an interesting relationship to each other and are not merely synonym. Like he just denied that synonymy was actually a thing.
Or the morning star is the evening star, Frege's famous example. Yeah.
I get all that. Maybe we're just being loose with the words, right? It either means that what you mean by is not identity, or it means that you just don't know what you're talking about when, or you're not being articulate about what you mean by identity and difference. So to me, I would take it meaning that what you mean by is something that isn't identity. Equal is not the same as identity, or entailed with, but is, it does not mean that.
So I'll take the blame because I started off with the A equals B thing. So let's just erase equal sign. Right. And just stick with the word is.
No, but this is what he's doing. I think you don't have to take the blame. Hegel can take the blame.
So I think when Hegel is talking about it in this section, he doesn't talk about identity and difference. Right. He's very hard on subject object. He keeps talking about universal in particular and subject and object. So I don't think Hegel is thinking in terms of we're talking that predication of this sort is an identity statement.
No, he does say this here. He does.
And well, it doesn't, I'm trying to allay Dylan's concerns to some extent and just get to this other point, because I think this is ultimately where I was trying to get to. So he's saying, look, a synthetic judgment of this sort that has a subject and a predicate is putting heterogeneous elements. This is page 69. One is the particular. How are synthetic judgments a priori possible? This problem expresses nothing else but the idea that subject and predicate of the synthetic judgment are identical in the a priori way. That is to say, these heterogeneous elements, the subject, which is the particular and in the form of being, and the predicate, which is the universal and in the form of thought, are at the same time absolutely identical. And he says, this original synthetic unity must be conceived not as produced out of opposites, but as a truly necessary, absolute, original identity of opposites. So Hegel's saying, look, it's not like we're going from the bottom up, right? And this is his characterization of Kant, by the way. This is not Hegel's solution at this point. He's saying, Kant says the identity of these two heterogeneous elements is already there, right? This is what Wes was saying. It's already in, I don't even want to use the Kantian language. It's already there in our intuition or whatever it is, whatever it's called. And so when we make these statements, it's not like we say, oh, how's it possible in the same way that an a posteriori, like if you say this table is white, you literally are putting a universal and a particular together and you're kind of taking the particulars and you're working your way up. He's like, no, synthetic a priori judgments don't work that way. It's not like we have the particular and the universal, we put them together and we're like, wow, there's a synthetic judgment. And that's how we get 7 + 5 = 12. No, it comes from the top down. We get 7 + 5 = 12 because it was already there. What would that actually mean? What does that look like? And
is that what he's saying?
This is what he's saying Kant says.
No, I think this is what he thinks actually, but he thinks Kant, it's there in Kant, just Kant doesn't realize it, but yeah.
It could be that this is his characterization, but he thinks this is how Kant solved the problem, and it's here.
Like Kant doesn't say that subject and predicate are identical, yes, in an a priori way. This is Hegel, but yeah.
And I mean, I would swear, and I would have to go back to my Critique of Pure Reason, but the whole thing about 7 + 5 = 12 is that it is a synthetic a priori judgment. It's the whole deal is that it is combining two things that weren't there before, so that every piece of it. Now you can quit. Hegel doesn't like this, but it's still synthetic.
Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsors for this episode, starting with Shopify. Starting something new isn't just hard, it's terrifying. So much work goes into this thing that you're not entirely sure will work out, and it can be hard to make that leap of faith. We're very familiar with that here at PEL. When we started this podcast, we weren't sure what we were doing. We didn't know if anyone would listen. Now we know that despite all the fears and hesitations, it was the right thing to do. And it also helps to have a partner like Shopify on your side if you're going to be selling products. Shopify is the e-commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. From household names like Gymshark, Cotopaxi, and Allbirds to brands that are just getting started. Get started with your own design studio. With hundreds of ready-to-use templates, Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store that matches your brand style. Accelerate your efficiency, whether you're uploading new products or trying to improve existing ones. Shopify is packed with helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/PEL. Go to shopify.com/PEL. That's shopify.com/PEL.
Here's a question worth sitting with for a second. When's the last time you actually thought about where your team's work happens? Because here's the thing. It's not on servers anymore. It's not behind a VPN. It's in the browser. Gmail, Slack, your CRM, your project management tools, all of it living in browser tabs. And that's exactly where the threats are showing up too. Phishing, shadow IT, data leaks. They're following your work right into those SaaS apps and live sessions. So NordLayer just launched something that meets the problem where it actually lives. It's called NordLayer Browser, a business browser built specifically for small and medium-sized businesses that need real security without the enterprise price tag or the headache. IT teams get visibility and control directly at the source, meaning inside the browser itself where the work is happening. You can protect your company data, standardize security across web apps, and manage it all without disrupting the way your people actually work. No heavy tooling, no training nightmare. It's familiar from day one, easy to deploy, and it doesn't slow anyone down. If your organization has been living with security tools that were built for a different era, before everything moved to SaaS, before the browser became the workplace, this is worth a look. Don't get caught running yesterday's security on today's web. Check it out at nordlayer.com/browser. That's nordlayer.com/browser.
Okay, the one thing to add to that, though, is that judgment comes along at a conscious level, but that's after a lot of work has been done unconsciously. By the imagination. So the imagination went and it schematized and it kind of wove together reality, the reality of the appearances, the quote unquote reality of the appearances, not as things in themselves, but as objects of thought. And it does that, all of that under the radar. We're not aware of it. And then we come back and we find that 7 + 5 = 12, and we have to do it by counting through all the numbers. But we can only do that because at some primordial level, things have already been put together and it's all one at bottom, but we can find difference in it. It is very paradoxical, but look, you know, we saw this with like Plato's Parmenides. How do you kind of talk about the way that universals and particulars are related? It's endlessly paradoxical. And Hegel, I think, in a way, wants to acknowledge that paradox and just wants to say there's some deeper level of reality where they're not distinct. And that God, they become distinct through what he calls sacrifice in the phenomenology. God sort of gives himself up to a man, right? He creates the world. He creates the manifold. So the infinite yields the finite and shows that the finite was already in there anyway. They're already identical. It's not going to make sense beyond the, it's a poetry.
Just to return for the final time to my stupid attempt at the ontological argument, you've said why I could not actually fully state it is because I'm seeing myself as finite poetically as a barnacle on the infinite or something. But that argument does not make logical sense. The Locke is just going to say, okay, you've perceived yourself as finite. End of story. There's no necessity that there be a not finite. Just because you say something is green doesn't mean that there is some fundamental not green that is. Well, it's just the things that aren't, you know, it's Plato's in the Sophist. Negation is just something else. So not finite would just have to be if maybe there actually is nothing that opposes the finite, because everything is finite and you're just playing with words.
The argument is that because you can think it, it must exist.
Yeah.
Because you can think God, God must exist. Because you can think the infinite is not something that is just all of a sudden thinkable by a finite creature like you. If you were truly finite, if all there was the finite, you wouldn't even be able to think the infinite.
Yeah.
All right. So two more quotes from the next two pages. He says, but in Kant, the synthetic unity is undeniably the absolute and original identity of self-consciousness, which of itself posits the judgment absolutely and a priori, or rather as identity of subjective and objective. The original identity appears in consciousness as judgment. This is how Kant truly solved his problem. How are synthetic judgments a priori possible? They are possible through the original absolute identity of the heterogeneous. This identity, as the unconditioned, sunders itself and appears as separated into the form of a judgment as subject and predicate or particular and universal. Now, Dylan, to your point, you're like, this just is hokum, right? It sounds bizarre. But in the next short section, he's going to mention, you know, that the identity is actually in the word is and the copula, and this is not something provided by judgment. And he starts talking about imagination. So essentially, this is where he brings in the discussion of saying, in order for Kant to solve this problem, that he says, okay, well, they're already in the structure of consciousness, and judgment is just the intellect, like making sense of, in some sense, or coalescing aspects of this structure of consciousness that already exists. Well, where did the structure of consciousness come from? Well, it comes from this faculty of imagination is somehow implicated in this, right? And my understanding of this reading is that Hegel's saying, okay, so you say imagination, I say God, right? We'll just put it that way. And when you say imagination, you're limiting knowledge. That's not the absolute, right? You're limiting knowledge still in the subjective finite sphere. So even though I could be okay with your notion of consciousness, you know, the question of the categories being given the way they are. And I think when he starts to talk about reason as this absolute that somehow contains the intellect and imagination and the object all in one kind of thing, but doesn't have any content in itself. It's like, he's trying to say, like, if you see reason, really, just don't even call it reason if you don't want to, but it's like, you can't have a manifold of intuition with things in themselves and appearances that somehow get connected to this consciousness, which is structured in this way by imagination. And then we have the intellect applying judgments. And that's how he's like, what is it that holds all that together? Because that's really what's important here. That's the real thing that we want to go after. And then he's dissatisfied with the way Kant characterizes it and what work he gives it to do, I think, is ultimately. That's what came out of this for me.
Yeah, I had a quote a little earlier just on page 70, which there are random things that are bold in here. Maybe it's just the typeface and the way it was scanned. But I was reading it as important. So it was this movement from, we started to talk about individual analytic and synthetic claims, right? All bachelors are unmarried, or 5 + 7 = 12, that kind of thing. But we want to get to things like all actions, anything that happens has a cause. You know, so that ends up being for Kant a synthetic a priori claim, even though it's not an identity claim. But this is sort of what I'm saying, that all these things end up reflecting some underlying identity there. Anything that looks like a predication or, you know, ends up being somehow reducible to an identity claim, and the identity in particular here.
And Hegel does, by the way, in his figurative way, want to treat cause and effect as an identity claim, but go ahead.
Yes, which we should say.
In his crazy way.
We should say a little more about that, but it ends up being all synthesized. All these different synthetic identity claims are presented together in experience, right? That is Kant's whole point, is that you don't have to argue that everything is causal, because that's just baked in to experience. You don't have to argue that everything is spatial in terms of like Euclid's space, because that is actually just baked into experience. So Hegel says on page 70, this original synthetic unity must be conceived not as produced out of opposites, but as a truly necessary, absolute, original identity of opposites. So all the ego and then the contents of consciousness, those seem like they're opposites or, you know, just different events that these, yeah, say it's, this seemed to sum it up for me, that somehow there's a complete originary identity, which is kind of the way, you know, in some of its applications, just like Heidegger saying, being in the world is basic, right? You don't have to have being and then, oh, I'm Descartes. Is the world really out there? You don't have to think about, because everything comes together in the originary synthetic unity. So if you think there are diremptions that philosophy has to overcome, you're wrong. The original synthetic unity has them all packed together.
He's just Parmenides. Everything is one. That's all he is. He's just Parmenides.
Yeah. So when we experience causality, we are experiencing in time this, the fundamental unity of things. But for us, it is, you know, I think even Hegel has to admit, from the standpoint of subjective experience, right, this is all divided up. Right. We have a manifold. God is, I suppose, luckier than us. For him, it's all still fused together into a, like, what's the densest astronomical object that's not a black hole, like a neutron star or something? Everything is just compressed into this sameness. But from our standpoint, you know, as he diremps himself, as he severs himself from himself to give us the joy of existing and subjectivity and consciousness, which requires at least two, requires at least same and other, then yeah, that's the way we experience it in terms of division, the identity or the connectedness of things that are different.
It's the identity and this overriding identity of everything as everything else, which I guess I'll just go down the Parmenidean hole or, you know, Leibnizian, everything is reflected in everything else kind of mayor of the world, right? It doesn't address the question of distinction at all, that things are different from one another. If you just say, okay, well, look, everything that exists partakes of the world and is subject to the facts that it's the part of the world. Okay, fine. But a sentence like, everything is identical. It's just, I just check out at that point. It doesn't make any sense. It's just not true.
And it's not what he's saying.
It's like those sentences you read.
He didn't say everything is everything.
Identical. He didn't say everything is identical, but right. He's doing theology and he's doing deep metaphysics and ontology. And he's saying at some deeper level, there's this profound unity, and he wants to use this word identity, but if you want to be less offended, just replace it with unity. But yeah.
The original identity of opposites.
Opposites being the primarily the particular and
he sounds like the a universal, Taoist.
Which becomes the object and the subject.
Yeah. Subject predicate in a judgment, right? Or in a predication. So yeah, it sounds weird because he's not saying everything is everything. He's saying when you have a sentence or when you have a proposition like 7 + 5 = 12, the reason that he's trying to essentially give like truth conditions, right? Why is it possible? Why is that true? Why is 7 + 5 = 12 true? It's not because there's sevens in the worlds and there's fives in the worlds and there's 12s in the world and we see them in the appropriate relationship, like green car. Oh, the car is green. Okay. I saw that. Yep. A posteriori. Can't do that with 7 + 5 = 12. So, okay. Kant is like, I got to figure out how to say this is true in a way that preserves science, but doesn't offend anybody, blah, blah, blah. So that's his path he's off on. And Hegel's just saying, yeah, I agree with Kant. It's true because it's the structure of the world. It's already there. Like we discover it, we kind of learn it, we uncover it. You go out in the world and you don't ever see 7 + 5 = 12, but every seven things that you add to five things adds up to 12, right? And from that, maybe you can make the inference, the scientific inference, and come up with a quote unquote law of nature, right? And from our perspective as subjective beings, they're all ultimately in theory falsifiable, right? They're not really laws of nature, but we do think the statements are true insofar as they're true. And all Hegel's doing here, I think, is agreeing with Kant in some sense that...
Yeah, I mean, I think Kant doesn't, right, is not true the things in themselves for Kant. So it's more about Kant's saying it's objective because it's true of our cognition. It's something, right, we make 7 + 5 = 12 in spatial intuition, and then we come along to it with conscious judgment. And it's like, oh, look, yeah, there's 7 plus 5 equals 12. But Hegel is expanding that and saying everything Kant calls a form of sensibility or the categories, that is the deep structure of reality. And this is, I think, the part that maybe Dylan might like, right? It really is the world. This is about the things in themselves and the external world. To the extent that we can slice and dice consciousness and our cognitive faculties and weigh, say what the structure of cognition is, we just are talking about what the structure of the world is, because there isn't a good way to actually distinguish those two. And he actually has a little argument in here about that. But in the end, there's not a good reason for saying that we have these little special monadic beings in the world, subjects, which just have their own rules, right? And then they're going to apply that to the manifold as it comes at them. Here I am, this special subjectivity with my own rules. No, the subjectivity is also a being in the world. Its structure represents the structure of the world. It's a little bit crazy to say that there's this radical disparity between these unknowable things in themselves and the subject, so that those structures actually coincide. And I think that's a very plausible argument, which is what I was trying to defend to, what's his name, Graham Harman?
Yep.
Defend Hegel a little bit to Graham Harman on this point. I do think the whole thing in itself thing, that it's problematic. This idea of unknowable things in themselves actually does kind of fall apart. And I think this is very insightful of Hegel to figure that out. But yeah.
And I think he goes even a little bit further in that he's saying there's a really profound insight here from Kant that there's this, and we call it, you know, I grew up learning to call it intention, but the whole notion that consciousness is intentional, subject, object, right? Subject, predication, that this we're just, it is the nature of subjectivity of a humankind anyway, to be oriented towards the world as an object and to be oriented towards objects and to treat things in that way. And to give this account of consciousness that he does, and I'm talking about Kant here, that is ordered, because for Hegel, subject-object is the equivalent of talking about particular and universal. And he's like, yeah, you're right. Everything is ordered and structured this way. And that's why we go out in the world and we see it. And that's why, and I think he's really, 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 and I may not be on camera for you, but I'm making hand gestures right now with my fists. He's trying to say that Kant doesn't really appreciate fully the depth to which this somehow structures consciousness and subjectivity, that he still wants to keep this kind of barrier. It's like, he's like, yeah, it's all subject object and I'm the infinite subject over here. And the manifold is the, and the things in themselves are the infinite object over there. And Hegel's like, what about the is? What about the thing that's bringing you to, what about the structure that you just described? What about this synthetic structure you just described? How could you possibly be participating in that as a subject and think that the object is so far away from you? Because if you believe that synthetic judgments a priori are true by the imagination or by work that's not done by the actual experiencing of the appearance, why wouldn't you think that the things in the world that you're experiencing as a subject are just as valid and be fixated on this appearance reality, you know, this appearance things in themselves distinction, the noumena phenomena? And I think that's a legitimate question. And I think in the rest of the essay, to some extent, he goes on to try to say he's got this mechanism, this whole architectonic set of definitions and books that he's writing, trying to figure out how he cannot, Kant would love to overcome the phenomenal and the noumenal distinction, but he's got such fidelity to this idea that he lays out here that in all the other works and all the way he tries to describe the other faculties and all that, he can't find it in himself to say, wow, maybe we are just beings in the world and it actually is what I think I'm seeing, kind of a thing. And I think that's the critique that Hegel's laying out here. I'm done.
In the end, he wants to say, as we get to 72 and 73, that this thing that Kant's calling the imagination is reason, capital R, is the idea, capital I, is the thing in itself. It's just the way it looks from inside. The way it looks to an empirical consciousness from the inside is what we call this activity of the imagination. But really, it's like the process of reality, the process ontology. So it's almost, if you can imagine imagination as something not just belonging to a particular subjectivity anymore. Maybe it belongs to God, or maybe it just think of it in terms of some synthetic process to reality, right? Reality weaving itself together in this way, synthetically making itself, you know, making itself temporal and spatial and causal and all these other things, just doing it spontaneously so that the Kantian subjectivity doesn't have to do it for reality. It already does it for itself. And then when we grasp all these things that are there in reality, we just, in a way, participating in that process of that unifying process. So it's not that Kant is exactly wrong about all these crazy things that the mind does and that spontaneously does. And we can see it in the brain. The brain is doing a lot, right? I mean, we might be tempted to say, because the brain does so much, it can't be, its doings can't be what's real. It must be processing. But the point here is that its doings are the world's doings, and what its doings are in some fundamental sense identical to the doings that it's making something of.
And Hegel has a wonderful word to describe what you just outlined, Wes. Spirit.
Yeah.
Spirit does all the work for him that you just described without being pure subjectivity.
Sure. We had put this whole thing earlier in our consideration of the phenomenology, and really other than Nyayas and stuff is doubting the doubt, right? That Kant is being dogmatic, Hegel says, in insisting on this split between the phenomena and the noumena, and it ends up just being unjustified. That if you actually stick to your premises and approach the world from your point of view within the world, from your being in the world, then you're not going to find this sharp distinction, you know, that there's something foreign coming in from that, and which ends up being an unwarranted form of skepticism, right? To think that, well, I think I know everything there is about this object, but maybe it has a real essence that's beyond any possible way that I could experience it. That was Graham Harman's position.
You know, the rest of this, we kind of set the groundwork where he's talking about the imagination and identity and all that stuff, where he thinks he's getting out of Kant an idea that Kant didn't take seriously enough. But then he goes into a pretty cantankerous critique of Kant and Kant's errors and the way that leads him to this severing of God off from knowledge in a way he doesn't like.
So I feel like we've gotten to the point of real philosophical urgency here. However, as far as the number of pages in the Kant section that we have covered, we've gotten only the very beginning of it. So we certainly could talk for another 2 hours, especially if we were to take the footnotes seriously, which, you know, the editors nicely put in, and somehow come up with a reasonable, you know, no more than 30 pages in total of actual Kant to read, so we can see. Because it does seem like we spent this much time on Hegel. We know that he has a lot of agreement with Kant, disagrees him about the things in themselves, but like, it would be nice to actually understand the detailed points of disagreement. But it's really just a matter of how much more time we want to spend on this and how much, whether the audience would find that entertaining. You know, we could just do a part three to go through for the supporters, the ones that really care about this, some more of the points, or we could make a meal of it and have a whole 2 hour thing 2 weeks from now. What's the vote here?
So read a little Kant and continue discussing. Is that the idea?
Yes.
Read a little Kant, do a little Hegel.
Get down tonight. Yes. Is that okay, Seth? You were saying just another hour, but we could actually understand this a little better if we bring in some Kant, if that is doable.
I mean, if we keep it focused.
Right.
The Kant part, I mean.
A small reading from because Kant.
Hegel mentions at least 7 different contexts.
All right. So it'll be one of those things for our next installment here. And then we had planned to get back to Hegel's phenomenology and actually talk about faith.
I'll believe it when I see it.
And then we're going to get to pragmatism, which will be very different than this kind of reading experience. Thanks for going through this all with us. We appreciate your support and your listening and your nice 5-star reviews that you've either already left or are about to go leave right now. You can email us, pel@partiallyexaminedlife.com, with topic ideas, comments, things that we're missing from our naivete and our lack of familiarity with these figures. Whatever you want to put out at us, we can take it. See you next time. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.